Good morning. This is Carolyn Murray with the Local News Hour, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. KPCW News Time is 8:13. Well, this morning I have Colin Hilton on the line. He's the foundation president and CEO of the Olympic Exploratory Committee. This committee has been established by the state legislature, and it's an effort to take the next steps in bidding for the 2024 or 2030 Olympics. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Carolyn.
So a big weekend, I suppose. Lots of phone calls, lots of people wanting to talk with you.
Yes, certainly this past week was a big step forward for Utah, Park City, Salt Lake, and the entire region to begin a more formal discussion about interest to host the 26 or 2030 games.
Yeah, so a legislative audit found that there are about $40 million in upgrades to the Utah Olympic facilities that are needed before even a bid can begin. So can you talk a little bit about that for our listeners?
Sure, would love to. Nobody typically likes to have a state legislative audit done, but actually it was a really good thing for the state officials to confirm and validate what I've been mentioning for years, and that is our foundation alone does not have the financial resources to do the proper maintenance and upkeep of these Olympic venues over the next 10 years, and we need some help. So the legislative audit validated those needs, and it is not for the operations of running that. Our legacy fund, which is made up of profits from the O2 Games, have been taking care of those operating costs for 15-plus years. What we have is a number of large capital improvements, like a roof of the Olympic Oval or retaining walls of the bobsled track that are beginning to fail. Those are critical big items that need to be taken care of in order for us to properly host a future games.
Well, sure. And so, but those are needs that are there regardless of whether an Olympic Games comes back to Utah. Is that right?
That is true. And we kind of differentiated a portion of that projected $40 million over 10 years into two categories. Items that would repair and replace existing 2002 infrastructure, and also categories of improvements that would allow us to come to current and future standards of being able to continue to train athletes and to host international events. And between the two categories, that averages about $4 million a year over the next 10 years.
So that $4 million that is discussed in reference to the $76 million endowment that was established from the 2002, that $4 million is representative of what's needed between today and being ready to host.
So a little bit of clarity on that. The amount of monies that a current value of our legacy fund at $60 million earns about $4 million a year in investment earnings. We use that to subsidize the maintenance and operations of the facilities, but it doesn't cover the large capital improvements that we project are going to increase from about $2.5 million a year to over $4 million a year when you look at large capital improvements that are going to be able to allow us to keep the facilities at a world-class level.
So between 2013 and 2016, it looks like visitors to our facilities are substantially up, and that events, both national and international events, are up, what, some 50%?
Yes, I would say one of the key talking points that I reference is we are now four times busier than we were just after the Olympic Games in 2002. And that increased volume is terrific from a story of we're using our facilities both for the athletic purposes, the sport legacy, if you will, as well as for community recreation center uses and for public activity outings. I'm sure many of the listeners, and when you have family members, people bring folks up to the Olympic Park or down to Soldier Hollow or the Olympic Oval in Kearns, and they are vibrant and active, and that's what our view of an Olympic legacy is all about. But it comes at a wear and tear cost, and we are certainly excited to be able to have the state step up and be able to help us make sure that these facilities remain viable and working and are safe and are meeting current day standards of being able to train athletes and serve the community.
So the audit language, it does refer to the several venues that need to be upgraded, as you've mentioned. But is it ultimately the legislature that does decide on whether Salt Lake City goes for the bid?
Well, the Olympic Exploratory Report is happened to be timed in the same week as this audit report, but they're very much interrelated. The Exploratory Committee that's made up of both athletes and political leadership as well as business leaders throughout Salt Lake, Park City, and the greater Utah region are now tasked with checking in with each of the Olympic communities, cities, and the venues that hosted in 02, and to ensure that there is still interest and a viability of a community to be able to host the games. We did a similar effort back in 2012 when we were exploring the 22 Olympic Winter Games, and we had overwhelming support. We don't want to take that for granted. We want to have the discussions, and that is what the Exploratory Committee intends to do over the next 90-day period.
Oh, it's a pretty tight time frame, 90 days then, and then a recommendation will be made to the state legislature?
That's correct. At the end of January, and it's not just to the state legislature, it's a report to each of the community's governing bodies and to the citizens at large. I think you'll see a public opinion poll that will be redone, much like it was back in 2012, where there was over 80% support back in that poll. But that discussion, we don't want to take that for granted. We want to have the dialogue. We want to check in with the Summit County Council, the Park City Council, the citizens, and each of the communities throughout Utah. And I'm pretty fortunate with my foundation, as I have locations in three very distinct communities in the Heber Valley with Soldier Hollow. So checking in with Wasatch County and Heber Valley, that is critical to making sure that our facilities and the community are excited and interested to look at hosting another Winter Games.
So Fraser Bullock was quoted as saying, "The bid, we will be on the up and up, no squirrely stuff going on." What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a reference. Obviously, back in the 90s, there was the bid scandal that is part of the history, and it's very much made sure that a foundation like mine is very transparent. We do these state audits. We are very open process. And that is will be an absolute hallmark going forward. There is, a lot of reflection on the rest of the world where the Olympic movement is not being warmly embraced. And quite frankly, the Olympic movement could use a location like Utah to highlight sustainable and cost-effective way of hosting a future game. So our commitment is to absolutely be very transparent, very open, and very much receiving of concerns that elected officials and citizens bring to our attention.
Sure. And so Los Angeles has another Olympic event. Is that correct?
Yes. So they were awarded the 2028 Summer Olympics, and that poses a complexity for us to host the 26 games. So a lot of the focus is probably going to be centered on 2030, and only would in a unique scenario where maybe Salt Lake and Utah were the last one standing, perhaps 26 is actually the more possible scenario. But there is a complexity given LA hosting 2028 and controlling the sponsorship and marketing rights through that period.
Yes. Okay. So at $167 billion, as far as the budget that I've read,
$1.7 billion. Yes. Not $167 billion. $1.7 billion.
It's still an inconceivable number. So how how does a city with no infrastructure, let's say a competitive city like Denver or like, Tahoe, or how do they even begin to approach this?
And it's a great question, and we welcome that comparison because we don't feel that that makes any economic sense or cannot pencil out. So for us in the United States, we feel Utah is uniquely positioned to show reuse of existing infrastructure that has now a commitment from the state to help our foundation maintain these very expensive and high labor, high utility type facilities to remain viable. And the actual exercise of stating that we are a balanced budget is what this exploratory committee's work group is going to look at over the next 90-day period to be able to more effectively say we've looked at this and we think it's viable. So we've got some work to do, and it's going to be an interesting exercise over a 90-day period, and the results of which we will make available at the end of January.
Sure. So here, let's ask you about the inconceivable, which is climate change and the realities of temperatures in January and February and rain events and some of the projections about what, you know, our climate will look like here in Park City and
that,
Utah.
That is one of the key work groups looking at environment, climate, air quality issues. That is one for which we've asked Andy Bierman to spearhead that work group. Andy very much has been an advocate of this for Park City over the years, and Andy, having served on previous Olympic exploratory efforts, very much is going to help us explore that. Obviously, there was a great report done by Save Our Snow back many years ago, and that is a very big concern of ours of what the snow level looks like at the base of Park City Mountain Resort come 2026 or 2030, and how are we going to forecast being able to stage a Winter Games with known changing climate issues. And that is very much a key effort. Certainly down in Salt Lake, an effort on air quality is going to have to be addressed. And that is a part of the exploratory efforts environment and climate work group to explore and be able to touch on the things that are going to have to be considered as we look at hosting in a much later future games date of 26 or 30.
So, Colin, I'm going to really put you on the spot now.
Sure.
What about mascots? Do we revisit those same mascots? Have they grown? Have they morphed into...
You know, powder, copper, and coal, yes, I think maybe want a little bit of a refresh from representation from back in 2002. So I welcome, I hope we get to that point that we are actually getting to that decision on that type of topic. I would look forward to that.
Yeah, and how about Mitt Romney?
You know, who knows where Mitt's ambitions are. I think what I feel most comfortable is we've got Fraser Bullock, who has been was our chief operating officer. Fraser is essentially our key leader on this effort, and we're following his lead. And we're going to grow the committee members on this exploratory. So I know there was a little wonder about representation from the listeners, but through the next 90-day period, we're going to add representation of people to these work groups. We're going to check in with each of the host communities, and we're going to ensure that voices are heard.
Well, thank you, Colin. Sounds like we've got some interesting things that'll be coming up in early 2018. Some big decisions.
Certainly. And with this being an Olympic Winter Games year coming up in Korea, we've got lots of terrific events that are going to be happening at our venues, everywhere from Deer Valley to the Olympic Park to the Olympic Oval down to Soldier Hollow. We've got Olympic trials and World Cups, and encourage everybody to come out and show Utah's support to what we're doing.
Okay, that was Colin Hilton with the Olympic Foundation, president and CEO. So as I mentioned, we've got Diane Foster, and we have Jonathan Weidenhammer in to tell us about the special meeting that is scheduled for tomorrow for City Council. And maybe, you know, there are people who follow the council meetings and may want to know why it's being rescheduled.
That's a great question. And it is technically a regularly scheduled City Council meeting. And in January, when we noticed all of the All the meetings for the year. This was actually identified as on this date. And the reason is that in the fall, every fall we work with the council on identifying when they're going to meet. And this was a date that there was a big Colorado Association of Ski Towns, of which Park City is a founding member, thanks to Miles Rademan. There was a big meeting on this day so that the council asked if they could move the meeting to a Tuesday. So they're not technically required to have the meetings on Thursday. In fact, we're one of the few councils in all of Utah that have them on that. Most of have them on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, like Wasatch County and Summit County.
Okay. Well, thanks, Diane, for that explanation. So at 2:30, Diane, the council is planning to interview applicants for the Public Art Advisory Board. Can you tell us a little bit about what this board will be tasked with? And, is it related to the new Arts and Culture District? Is this something that would have happened regardless?
Great questions. So the Public Art Advisory Board is actually a longstanding board that the city's had, and it's got a great group of people, all of whom are interested in the arts. You don't have to be an artist to be on that board. And they actually, the city has a budget for this, and so they advise the city council on how to spend money. So everything from, you know, your favorite sculpture around town to other types of public art to, Jonathan works a lot with the Public Art Advisory Board, 1% of our capital projects. So with every capital project, 1% is put to public art. There are some exclusions in there. However, so if you look at the piece of the library as you walk in the coffee shop on the left-hand side, the art there was part of that budget.
So we've never had a public advisory board.
No, we've had one for a long time. This is just, we've got a couple seats open, and so city council's interviewing, I believe they're appointing up to 2 people. Although they also have the ability, just like a recreational, what they did recently with recreational advisory board, they actually increased the size of the board because they had good applicants and wanted to put more on that. That's really an unusual situation. So I expect them to, and they have more candidates than positions open.
Okay, and so the application process is closed at this point and decisions are being made today.
It is at this point, but it's a good time of the year to remind folks to, if you're interested, it's a great way to participate or to get started in government is to serve on a board or commission. I served on the Eastside Planning Commission with Summit County for 5 years, and that has been an invaluable experience. As Jonathan will tell you, if you're having planning experience is incredibly helpful in government.
Okay, Jonathan, so the Kimball Arts Fest debrief, it sounds like feedback has been quite positive for the event this summer. So would anything change for next year?
No, we're very happy with the relationship. We have a long-term contract. This past year, I think, was the first year of the newer contract, and we're really just going back and telling everybody how well we did. We increased numbers, we decreased traffic, and overall, the festival is a great success.
Okay, and then we've had some in the news recently, some discussion about the AAA
Triple Crown softball and baseball.
Sorry. Yeah.
Right.
So there was a fair amount of pushback from the organization saying, boy, you don't sound like you value us, and if you're not willing to increase our contract and allow us to play where we want to play, we may just take our ball and bat and go home.
Well, I don't believe it's contentious at all. I mean, I think it's the evolution and the ongoing process that the community is going through with our relationship with events. 10 years ago, when we first brought Triple Crown, it was very much a tool to fill out our summer tourism economy. And I think that's something we've done in spades and been very successful with. As we've created the Special Event Advisory Committee, or SEAC, you know, we've gotten more community representation saying, hey, why are we doing this? You know, why are we unnecessarily bringing in more traffic and more congestion? And so essentially we came down to negotiating a few finer points of that contract, and we did that publicly to allow for good dialogue and transparency. And on one hand, you have kind of the residents, and the other hand, you have Triple Crown, who have brought a good tournament to town. And I think the crux of the discussion ended up being, do we want to let them use City Park or not? The staff was recommending that we don't do that in order to protect Old Town and protect bringing more cars and traffic into Old Town. And I think the Lodging Association and Triple Crown came back and said, hey, we're employing people in town. We're creating year-round economy, and this is a reason I have a home here and a business here, and there's balance. And I think council at the end of the day found a really good balance. Their approval of using City Park, which they ultimately did, was based on the ability to mitigate for ongoing trips into the Old Town. So we expect to see a more robust transit and carpooling plan from Triple Crown.
And City Council did actually cut the budget. So they cut the amount of subsidy that Triple Crown was getting. And they actually have now a contract to reduce that every year over the next, I believe it's a 3-year contract, so $10,000. So that's a significant hit. And it is City Council saying, well, you need to stand on your own. And with regard to playing in City Park, one of the points considered was that it doesn't affect the locals' leagues in the evening. They play during the day. So there wasn't necessarily a conflict there.
So, yeah, what about those city fees? Will the city be reducing financial support for the Kimball or for the Silly Sunday Market?
So the Silly Market, do you want to take that one?
Again, those things are all part of the negotiations and the ultimate contract we have with them. In each case, we have reduced the city subsidies. I think Kimball, maybe to a lesser degree, we've actually capped that. So as the inflationary costs of doing that business rises, our level of support will stay the same. But for Silly Market and for Triple Crown, we've significantly reduced the amount of city subsidies for those events. And when I say subsidies, it's really the cost of providing city services, where in the past we've completely waived all those. Now we're, again, cutting the amount by about half to each the Silly Market and to Triple Crown.
Okay. Now, sticking with events discussion, what about the Tour of Utah? What's happening with that for next year? I know they're...
We're currently in talks with them to try to find a way to bring them back. We've maintained a very strong relationship with them. Outdoor recreation events are something near and dear to our hearts, especially ones that align with international flair and state support. And we've always told them we want them here and we want them back. We had a conflict because of the dates last year with Kimball. And Kimball's, you know, the priority there. But we're very much looking forward to holding a stage here in Old Town this year. In a perfect world, it's that finish last stage. But with construction at the Kimball and anticipated construction at the Brewpub Plaza, it might be a bit challenging, so we're talking through options with them right now.
Mm-hmm. So do you anticipate that if we were to hold, I mean, thousands of people come for that event, if we do hold something like that this summer, would we have Richardson set up? Would there be shuttle systems in place? Would we basically shut cars down to the Old Town area? What happens with that?
Those are all possibilities, especially because, as you saw last year, we tested in partnership with Sundance going to Richardson Flats for the first 4 days of the festival and running buses out there. So that was quite successful. So I think what you've seen across all events this summer is Jonathan, Jenny Dearson, and the entire events team doing a very good job of what City Council heard from SEAC, which was, we need to mitigate traffic, and that's what council has directed us to do, and traffic and all impacts to locals. So things like physically putting people on Park Ave to keep Uber drivers from circulating on Park Avenue and keeping that a locals-only street. Those types of things are incredibly successful. And really what we've heard from the community is it's not the events we don't like, it's that we get significantly inconvenienced by them.
What comes with the events, mm-hmm. right? So, Jonathan, let's move on. There is going to be an hour-long discussion about the Main Street Plaza and its uses. What are you hoping comes out of that?
Well, I am the economic development director for the city, so I mean, I've been accused that the report is biased already, and I guess I'll understand where people feel that way. Again, this is the plaza at the south end of the street adjacent to the brew pub, and the city is intending to build a parking garage there with a plaza at street level. And that plaza, the council has been very clear they want it to be a park, something that residents and neighborhood and visitors can enjoy, but it's not meant to be an actively programmed event space or event plaza. And so my perspective is that between the planning use process, you know, that Bruce Erickson and his team will regulate, and between the special event process that the city council has authority over and sets parameters of use and how much and how many days and what type, staff is coming in with a pretty firm recommendation that we have the existing tools in place to regulate the uses there. And I think you've seen the neighborhood coming back and saying, gosh, this is going to unduly and unfairly impact us and our quality of life because of all the noise, because of bringing additional uses. It's going to bring traffic and congestion. And the question for council is, hey, are you okay with the current event process, or do you want to put another layer of kind of restraints or constraints on that plaza, say no amplified music or no use after five or whatever those things are, to balance the commercial benefit and the perceived impacts. Again, when the 205 building across the street never ended up with any retail in it, there's been concern that we're not bringing people to that end of the street. You know, with the grade and it being uphill, there's always been a perception that, you look up there, do I really want to walk up there? What's up there? And part of this exercise for us, in addition to building the place, is to build an anchor or a draw so that the entire street is seen, so the entire street is used. And the balance of that is we are focusing some activities up there. More people might go up there. So it's really a balance question for council.
Right. So are the noise issues different up there than they are down lower in the street?
I think that's subjective. You know, I've lived in Old Town for a long time, and I think noise it bounces around all over these canyon walls, and you know that. If you're uphill above this thing, you're going to hear it. If you're right across the street from it, you're going to hear it. I'm not sure that's any different than Lower Main. Lower Main has some bigger buildings, and the canyon's a bit wider. The Bob Wells Plaza right out the window has City Hall in the back of the post office. So, yeah, I mean, I think each place is different. We haven't done any technical acoustic studies of what the noise may or may not do up there.
Well, I mean, if you take every pocket park and area of events and started to write out code that's different for each of those, it just seems like you might be getting into something way bigger.
Sounds like you could be in the economic development world. I agree with you. I mean, it's hard to write, individual codes for individual places. We think we have good process in place between the planning department's rules and the self the special event rules.
Okay, so under some old business, the council is looking. I guess you're holding a public hearing tomorrow. And you're going to possibly take some action on some amendments to the chain store ordinance that was approved in August.
Yeah, correct. In August, the city council adopted a cap of 24 chain stores on Main Street, I think 17 south of Heber and 7 north of Heber. We have 4 of those spaces left south of Heber and I think 6 left north of Heber. And we're doing 3 things to clarify. The first is create what we're calling a pipeline, which is, hey, if I'm L.L. Bean and I'm going to move into the Kimball garage, I don't want to do $200,000 of tenant improvements without being assured that I can get that business license. So we're setting up a process where you can actually apply and hold one of those cap spaces for up to 2 years until you complete your tenant improvements and have the ability to have that license finally approved. The second thing we're doing is what we started to call a tail. We're going to refine that to call it a grace period. And that would allow an existing chain business or an existing landlord who has a chain business in them to have that business relocate within the district and not essentially be penalized, right? So if I'm a chain and I want to move from one building on Main Street to another, I can pick up my license and move without going to the back of the line, without being spit out the back. And then the third piece is clarifying what can happen during Sundance or the Convention and Sales License or CSL. And what we're saying is that you can you cannot do a chain business in a storefront during Sundance, meaning I can't completely take over the front of my store and bring in Starbucks and serve Starbucks coffee. I can't even bring in Starbucks coffee and give it away. If Starbucks wants to market their Save the World campaign that they're doing in a foreign country, they can do intellectual things like that, but that conducting of business isn't going to be allowed.
Okay, so public input on those 3 amendments is what is
correct.
Happening.
Correct.
Tomorrow.
And we've been meeting with a pretty robust and deep stakeholders group on and off about this. And it's, it's a tough one, but we're continuing to progress and move forward.
And there remains still a lawsuit that's out there. A couple of Main Street business owners, they filed a lawsuit over the ordinance, but the city hasn't been served yet.
I'm not aware of.
So the city technically hasn't been served. That can take, I believe, up to 90 days. But our legal team did go out and get the lawsuit so they could see it. I don't think city council is going to be frightened off by a lawsuit on this. This is something that we've heard very good support from the community on. And I think, city council it's always a tough position because they're trying to find balance. And this doesn't eliminate all chain stores. This says now and into the future, we want to make sure that we have a balance of chains and not chain stores. We don't want it to look like every other ski town. And having been to Aspen, you know, you look at that town and it sort of feels like anywhere USA.
So are we hopeful that the amendments will deter that lawsuit?
The chain ordinance itself will deter that. These amendments do, and kudos to Jonathan and Rebecca and Hannah and the whole team who's been working on this. They went out and met with the stakeholders. And so what we did was council voted and put the chain ordinance in place. And then they then came back and said, you know what, we don't want to make this onerous for people who are in that process. So because of the steps of our process, there would be a lot of people having to make business commitments and be in limbo. We wanted to minimize that amount of time that they would be in limbo or, if possible, eliminate it. And so these are actually business-friendly amendments. It doesn't expand how many chain stores will be on Main Street, but it does give people some certainty. It also gives some certainty to property owners because they get to be able to have a certain period of time where they can go out and fill another chain in. So it just creates it's trying to level the playing field.
I see. Okay. So finally, the council will be deciding on whether to support winter balcony enclosures, and there's a pilot program underway?
There has been. This is year three of a three-year pilot program, and this is another one of those that was difficult balance. When City Council initially approved this, it was a 3-2 vote, and the mayor was disappointed was very concerned about the visual impact. The alternative, though, and why council in the end supported this was that balcony enclosures were an alternative to having tents there. So they were environmentally better because even though they're glass and they're not perfect from an insulation perspective, it's better than a tent. So heating a tent versus heating glass. City Council expected that there would be a number of folks who would follow suit and request that, and they didn't. They wondered what it would look like if all of Main Street, anybody who had a balcony, was enclosing it. It turns out only the River Horse was the only organization that wanted to. So staff is recommending a continuation of the program. It's been pretty limited in scope and impact.
Okay. And just quickly, can you give us an update on the Mountain Accord lawsuit? It sounds like Park City may be named in that.
I'm haven't seen that and don't know the background on that one.
Okay. I understand there's an open meetings training that's going to happen.
Yep. Annually, by law, we do open and public meeting training for all of our boards. So Polly Samuels McLean will be doing that. And it actually can be pretty interesting and fun. And we do, Jonathan's looking at me like I'm crazy. but they made it fun last year and showed some interesting videos. And it is actually something we very much believe in. The values of transparency and appropriate process are incredibly important to our city council and staff. And so we look forward to doing this every year.
Well, thank you for coming in. Jonathan Wiedenhammer, Economic Development Director for Park City Corporation, and Diane Foster, City Manager.
Thank you,
much.
Carolyn.
Good job.
Thank you. Nice
you did
guy.
Very well, Colin.
Campos Coffee at the base of Park City Mountain Resort. CamposCoffee.com.
DeJory Center is a proud sponsor of KPCW. Located in the heart of High Star Ranch in Camas, the DeJory Center is a multi-purpose event center complete with an indoor live performance arena, private dining rooms, meeting space, restaurant, and bar. More information at DeJoryCenter.com.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJoria Center at High Star Ranch, and Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, ESCO.
This is the Local News Hour. I'm Carolyn Murray. So October is Dyslexia Awareness Month, and we have Erin Grady, as well as Alyssa Attens. Alyssa is the PC Reads founder. And Erin, you're on the board. And you're in to give us an update on the McPolin pilot reading program from last year and how it's apparently rolling out to all the schools. Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about beginning what dyslexia is.
So, hi, good morning.
Good morning. This is
Alyssa Aiton.
This is Alyssa Aiton.
Yes. So put very simply, dyslexia is simply an unexpected difficulty with learning to read, write, and spell. There is a longer definition, but typically if you have a student that is really struggling to learn to read, write, and spell, and it's unexpected in relation to their other areas of academic work, it's very likely dyslexia.
And so does it manifest in any other ways besides just learning to read, write, and spell?
Yes. So reading is where you see it first for a young child. However, or not where you see it first, where you'll see it first in school, because we learn to read before we learn to write and spell. But there are many other signs. You know, a student may have trouble rhyming when they're young. They may have trouble tying their shoes. They may have difficulty telling time and direction left from right and right from left.
Okay, so a lot of different things to be aware of. And
yes.
And what are the interventions that happen and when do they happen?
Well, the earlier the better, and that's why this initiative has been so important, because it's bringing a reading program that benefits students who are struggling with reading. In fact, you know, some statistics are different, but about 70% of students may learn to read fairly naturally, and the other 30%, including your dyslexic students and your English language learners, really need to be explicitly taught how to read. And Wilson Foundations does that at the classroom level.
Okay, and so why is third grade such a pivotal time where we measure children's reading competency?
So, you know, up until third grade, you're really learning to read. And by third grade, you start reading to learn. And we would prefer to see struggling readers caught much earlier than third grade. It's not too late. It's never too late. And that's something Barbara Wilson will speak about on Wednesday night at the presentation. However, the earlier the intervention, the better. And the program that Barbara Wilson authored, she's actually authored many programs. She's an unbelievable expert in this field that is, you know, sought nationally and internationally. But Wilson Foundations is a classroom program that will hopefully prevent students from actually truly struggling to read. They'll be identified early. Some interventions will be given earlier, and by third grade, they will be reading.
So who will attend these events and presentations, Erin?
So we're hoping that administrators, teachers will come. We're also hoping parents that have any kids within the elementary school system, it will be super beneficial for them to kind of hear firsthand what's happening within the classroom. And that way, you know, understanding what's happening in the classroom, you can take home with you and also be supportive.
Okay. And do older children, older adults, older people in general struggle with dyslexia? And can they also be addressed in a program like this, like what Barbara Wilson offers?
I think yes. I can speak firsthand. I'm dyslexic. It's never gone away. It's something I deal with all the time. So, yeah, I think it's something that anybody can benefit from.
And the protocols are the same? They follow the same guidelines type of thing?
Well, you know, Barbara Wilson, being an expert in the field, has many different programs. The Wilson Foundations is a classroom approach. She has intervention programs such as Wilson Reading System, which she developed almost, I think, 30 years ago after working at the Massachusetts General Hospital Reading Disability Clinic with adults. She specifically started her career teaching adults to read. And Wilson Just Words is another intervention usually given in about fourth or fifth grade. So there are different probably approaches to assisting adult dyslexics to those who are children. But I think coming to this program on Wednesday night would benefit anyone.
I see. And so what about degrees of dyslexia? Do you have a range that you're working with?
There's definitely a range within dyslexia, and there's also dysgraphia. There's multiple things.
Okay. Yeah. And how many children would you estimate have dyslexia or have a reading disorder?
Right. So the estimates are that up to 1 in 5 individuals struggle with dyslexia. And it's definitely a spectrum. It can be affected by other issues. You know, some students may also have ADD or poor executive functioning or a poor working memory. So other disabilities may also be affecting their learning. But in general, up to 1 in 5 individuals.
Okay, and so is it a genetic condition?
Yes. The statistics actually show that if a parent is dyslexic, their child has a 40 to 50% chance of also being dyslexic.
Okay, and I understand we adopted the foundation's program last year, was it? And it's been piloted now in McPolin?
Yes.
And how has that been evaluated? How have you decided that this is something you're going to move forward with in all of the schools?
So the decision was not mine personally.
No, right.
However, you know, the initiative included the pilot of Wilson Foundations. It included some Orton-Gillingham training for some educators. And it also included PC Reads giving dyslexia awareness presentations to local elementary schools. It's a collaboration between PC Reads, the Park City School District, the Park City Education Foundation, and the Hall Family Fund. And so as far as the assessment, the Park City Education Fund provided an assessor, a volunteer assessor, who did a very thorough assessment of the program, which was presented to the school board, along with a thorough implementation plan developed by Julie Hastings. And the school board voted that they would move forward. And then with the funding provided by the Hall Family Fund, along with the school district financial commitment, we were able to roll it out. They were able to roll it out to the K-2 classrooms this year.
Okay, and what kind of expense are we looking at? What does a program like that cost a school district like ours?
The full implementation plan is actually available online if people want to get deep into the numbers. You know, I think it depends on what you include. Materials alone for the setup can run about $50,000 maybe for the district. But then it's not that amount isn't needed each year. However, the district also, you know, Julie Hastings has come on as an elementary curriculum specialist. So there are expenses that aren't as easy to capture.
I see. This process that's used, the foundations, is it pretty much foolproof? I mean, you've got a child that struggles, you're going to see progress?
I would say, speaking from experience with a daughter who is in third grade and has been using foundations, it's amazing to see the progress that she has just since August, since it's been with her tutoring and then within the school.
Okay.
And if teachers are given the support and the time to implement this, we do believe that we will see, you know, there is evidence from research that's been done that this will improve reading scores.
Well, and our school district recently went through some changes in the way we supported reading in the lower grades. We removed aides from the room but established a reading specialist to cover all the schools and all the programs.
Not quite. Okay. It is very, it's very confusing what's happened over the last few years. The reading aids were mostly eliminated. Some schools do still have some. And the interventionist positions were reduced. We used to have an interventionist that worked with ELL students and a separate interventionist that worked with reading. And that's been combined into one position at each elementary school. And why Wilson Foundations is helpful is because it is the tier one for the whole classroom teacher, as well as it provides the classroom teacher the ability to work with a small group setting with those teachers, those students who are struggling to read, which used to be more the responsibility of an aide.
Right. And when you say tier one, you're referring to all students.
All students, yes.
Right. Well, thank you. Erin, maybe you can give us an update on what's happening this month and the times and places and locations and...
So the most exciting is this coming Wednesday is Barbara Wilson is coming to speak, and it's free to everyone. It's at the high school at 6 p.m. in the evening. She'll also be here throughout the day on Wednesday and on Thursday, but working with our local administrators and teachers within the initiative program.
Excellent. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming in. That was Erin Grady, a board member for PC Reads, and Alyssa Attens, who is the founder of PC Reads.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much.